Bow hunters are some of the hardest working hunters there are. Most of us work hard all year long just to get a couple weekends or burn our vacation time to sit in a tree. And just like the American blue collar worker, we're trying to balance work, family, faith, and a little time for ourselves in the great outdoors. Now let me introduce you to Trollco Clothing, a brand built by blue collar workers for blue collar workers. Workwear, comfortable tees, hoodies and hats for both men and women, Trollco represents the hardworking American. So whether you're operating heavy equipment, wrenching on engines, or in a factory living that shift life, Trollco has your back, literally. Head to trollco.com/hunting. That's trollco.com/hunting and enter the discount code Empire25 for 25% off of your first order. Trollco, for the hardworking American.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable. Since 1988, Whitetail Institute has been perfecting annual and perennial seed products specifically for hunters who plant food plots. Their seeds have been engineered to be palatable, high in protein, and extremely attractive to deer. Whether you live in the Deep South or Midwest farm country, they have products that will help you grow your best food plot yet. For more information about their seeds and their blends, visit whitetailinstitute.com. Enter the discount code SE15 for 15% off.
All right, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Western Rookie Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Johnson. And today we are joined by a guy that I really like podcasting with. I've done it a ton of times over on some of the other podcasts that I host, but from the Missouri Woods and Water Podcast. And check this out. Missouri has an elk season. Do they still have that elk season?
Yep.
They do. Mr. Nate Thomas from the Missouri Woods and Water Podcast. Dude, how you been?
What's up, brother? I've been doing good. How about you?
I'm doing good, man. It's September 1st when we're recording this, so this will go out tomorrow. But we're in this time of year where it's just like, are you ready? Because if you're not, shit could hit the fan. In the hunting season. So I'm trying to get ready.
And I'm certainly not ready. I don't feel ready whatsoever, but that's, okay. That's another topic, I guess.
Are you ready or not? Nope. Okay. Good talk. See ya.
Nope. See ya. Yep. Congrats, guys. Yep. Exactly. It's one of them deals where like it's September 1st hits and you're like, oh crap. I need to shoot my bow more. I need to do this more. I need to do that more. The time that you have to do it seems to get less and less.
Yep. That's a fact. Before we get into like the meat and potatoes of like this episode that we're going to talk about, the elk hunts that you've gone on in the past, I got to ask you a question because we're roughly the same age, right? Are you 40? You're 40, right?
Yeah. I'm 42.
Okay. 42. I'm 44. I'm knocking on 45. What is it about this age where I don't know if you are going through this, but I know I'm going through this. I just don't give a shit about things anymore. Like, I don't know. I'll use this weekend as an example. I had a friend. He's like, hey, dude, I got some badass football tickets. Do you want to go to the game with me? I'm just like, no. And then it's like all these other things in life that some people could get really excited for. And I'm just like, nah, dude, like, don't care. Certain things that I used to care about, I'm just like, I don't give a shit about that anymore. Maybe I'm getting really cynical and turning into an asshole at my old age, but I'm just kind of curious. Are you going through that stage of your life at all?
Well, I didn't think I was, but I found out this weekend that I am. So specifically with the sporting events, I'm the same way. Like I'd rather just watch it in my house where I have a comfortable, climate controlled room to sit in, and I can go to my own bathroom, all those things. But at the same time, some people don't realize, like, I spend all my time sitting at games already, you know, like this whole weekend, my daughter had five games in a tournament to start the high school season off. And the last thing I want to do is go sit at another game, you know, after that. Right. And, we were watching the football game Friday night, you know, our high school season started and my son's a freshman. And so we're sitting there and I'm talking about the announcing or something. And I'm complaining about something. And my brother-in-law looks at me and goes, "You really are a cranky old man." And, it hit me. I didn't realize I was, but I have officially made it to that status. So I'm happy to be here. Thanks for joining the club.
Well, yeah, exactly. I've been in it though. I feel like I've been in it for at least 5 years, 4 years. Like there's something happens when you have kids and you're just running around like a maniac, getting them to all their events and shit like that. And then all of a sudden it's just like, you just sit down for 30 seconds. That's all you want is just to sit down for a brief moment and do nothing. And so the only people I really want to hang out with are my wife and kids anyway. Outside of that, it's just, like, whatever.
Yeah, that's exactly how it is. You hit the nail on the head. It's not that I don't want to be a dick. It's that I don't care anymore.
Exactly. Yeah, I just don't care. I just don't care anymore. I don't know. I wonder how long I'll be in that phase of my life, or maybe it's just like, congratulations, you're officially a man now. It's just like men, they have their priorities, and anything that's not in that priority window just does not get any attention at all. It's all or nothing, probably. And that's kind of how I look at it.
I'm not against it. Like I see the stuff that my kids go through, like my daughter and all the little things that she does for school and all the little tiny things. Oh, this girl I haven't commented on her picture and she's mad at me. And the whole time I'm sitting there like, who gives a shit? You know? And
my wife has those same conversations, by the way.
Yeah. And I'm just like, I do not like, I'm happy that I don't care about those sorts of things, which when you run a podcast, isn't the best thing because social media sort of is important and I could care less about
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
But, I guess that's the price I'm going to pay. I'm never going to be big time, and that's okay.
Yeah. Yeah. If that means I have to be on social media more, I'm okay with being medium because dude, I hate social media. I hate social media. Anyway, that's a completely different topic. We're going to get into the episode now, but before we do, I got to send a huge shout out to some of the partners here at the Western Rookie Podcast. First one is a broadhead company that I have been shooting since like 2005. I don't know. Are you familiar with the brand Wasp Archery?
Yep. Yeah. I met those guys before.
These guys have been around for a long time. Dude, absolutely love their heads. A majority of their heads are still manufactured in the United States. They have a huge lineup of mechanical and fixed blade broadheads. I shot my mule deer. For the last 13, 14, 15 years, I've pretty much killed all of my deer with a Wasp. Now I switch over to a fixed blade whenever I go elk hunting that we'll talk about today. But, I switch over to either like a Boss 4 blade or a sharpshooter or something, you know, a bigger head that doesn't allow for any energy loss upon deployment, like a mechanical head would. So go check out wasparchery.com. Enter the discount code NFC20 for 20% off. Next on the list is Montana Decoy. When you go out west and do your elk hunts, have you ever used a decoy before?
No, but I thought about it and I think I know which one you're talking about, but no, I haven't yet.
Yeah. So they're real light, right? They're like they're printed on fabric and they're ultra realistic looking. And so that allows it to have like a 3D look because the printing is so technical, I guess you'd say. So the only thing that I'm going to say at this point is go check out, I mean, they have antelope, they have whitetails, they have elk, they have moose, they have cows. I guess one thing that's really popular out west for antelope hunting is getting behind a cow decoy. They're so used to cows. And then you get a little closer. And then as the decoy moves off, there's somebody behind it. And then boom, you shoot an antelope. That sounds fun, actually. So go check out MontanaDecoy.com and check out all of their entire lineup of decoys. So huge shout out to Wasp and Montana Decoy for supporting the Western Rookie. Now, how many years have you done this Colorado elk trip?
Well, with the exception of 2 years ago, I drew a Wyoming tag, and so I didn't go to Colorado because I went to Wyoming. I think it was six years in Colorado. Yeah, somewhere like that. And then, like I said, 2 years ago, drew Wyoming and went to Wyoming with my brother-in-law. So we didn't go to Colorado that year. And then actually this year, I'm not. The guys are out there as we speak. I think tomorrow season's opens, or today, one of the two. And so with the exception of this year, been out for 6-7 years, somewhere in there.
Okay. Let me ask you this question. What all of a sudden made you guys just be like, hey, dude, let's go on an elk hunt in Colorado?
Yeah, it wasn't all of a sudden. So Andy, which is, you know, one of the three of us on our podcast, his dad has been going out west to Colorado elk hunting for 35 years. They used to take horses out there, you know, usually went out during like muzzleloader season or rifle season. So they would be taking horses out in the snow and all that stuff. And after Andy graduated college, he started going, and then my brother-in-law started going, and then it just kind of grew into a family thing. A few of the guys that Andy's dad were going with kind of got older and then passed away. And so the group just sort of morphed into the young guys and Roger and my father-in-law. Going out to the same general area that they had been going to for years. And so when I started, it was just kind of like, hey, you're going to come and this is where we're going. Right. So it was kind of just one of those, you know, I was in the club, as they say.
Yeah. Not a lot of thought into what you needed to do. You just basically needed to pack your shit and show up.
Pretty much. Yeah. That was like, yeah. I never, you know, we talk about going out west and preparing. Well, I didn't have to prepare about where I was going. They already told me where we were going. And now we can talk about things after the fact, looking back, if we want at this point. But yeah, like there was no picking where I was going to go or anything like that. It was just kind of like, hey, this is where we're going. Now, as we've hunted, there have been times where we've had to do that. But the first year, all I remember is you have to get a four-wheeler and you got to bring your gear. And that was it.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And so talk to us a little bit about what this elk hunt was actually like when you first started going, because it sounds like it was with a big group of people and, you know, four-wheelers and camps. Was this like out of a hotel? Was this out of like a wall tent? Did everybody have their own little tents, cabins? Break it down for us that way.
Yeah. So my very first year, I think there were, man, I got to count. Like it changes every year a little bit, but there was like 1, 2, 3, 4, like 7 of us, I think, my first year. And so, yeah. So the unit we were in, you can drive quads to certain areas of the unit. And so we would bring a big wall tent, a big outfitter's tent, if you think about it, big canvas tent, and actually a little toy hauler trailer. And so two trucks would go. One truck would have all the quads on it, and then the other truck pulled the trailer, or the RV, we'll call it, the camper. And so we would all camp in the wall tent. And then the little camper, my father-in-law actually came, and he was our camp cook. He did not hunt. He just liked going out with us.
Yep.
And he cooked breakfast for us. dinner when we got back at night, you know, that sort of stuff. And so in the mornings, he would get up first and have the heat running in the camper or the little electric heat, and then cook breakfast on the stove. And we would get up, you know, at 4 a.m, whatever, and sit and have eggs, bacon, whatever we wanted before we took off for about an hour and a half quad ride to the base of the mountains. And that was our setup, is just, you know, we camped about an hour and a half to 2 hours from where we were going to be hunting by quad. And that's kind of how it went. It was, and, you know, I didn't know anything differently. That's just,
yeah,
that's just how it was for me. Yeah.
Yep. Yep. So that sounds like, fun, right?
It was.
Okay. So talk to us a little bit about, cause I want to get into something here where there comes a point where having a big group of people is fun, but at the same time, now you have to try to, you have however many tags that you're trying to fill every year. And that can be difficult with that many people in the same kind of general area.
Yeah, so we definitely broke up. So basically each one of us had a hunting partner.
Yeah.
So like myself and my brother-in-law were together my first year. Roger and Andy were together, which is Andy's dad and Andy. They were together. You know, Grant, which is my other brother-in-law, and somebody else would be together. So usually we'd split up in teams of two. And the unit we were in was big enough that we could go to different slopes and different, you know, mountains and not even see each other. So that's kind of how we did it. We would just talk about where's everybody going to go, opening morning, second, you know, each day. And then we would go. And then, of course, that could change based on when we get somewhere. If there was four other quads parked and a bunch of other hunters beat us to the spot or whatever, you know, that could change stuff. But There were a lot of things about that were fun.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a lot of things about it that aren't fun, you know, because you're talking about, and this, remember, this is 6-7 years ago, but you're talking about over-the-counter guaranteed tags in Colorado.
Yeah.
And so that means everybody can go do the same thing, and it's over Labor Day weekend, and it's a unit that isn't hunting only, so people are also out there riding quads. Yep. For recreational purposes sometimes. So there were times where it was a very aggravating experience.
Mm-hmm.
But my first year was actually maybe one of the best years as far as seeing elk and all that. But, we can get into that later, but yeah, that's kind of the gist of it. We would camp down at the bottom and take quads up.
Gotcha. How many people were you fighting? Most years, like as far as the pressure from other hunters,
it would vary. That was the weirdest part. Like my first year was amazing. You never saw anybody. I mean, there were other camps and you knew other people were hunting, but I never saw another hunter.
Yeah.
My second or third year, we just talked about getting older. So my memory started to suck too. Yeah. My second or third year, Dan, it was like going on a walk in a park. Like we ran into hunters all the time. And I'd be up in the middle of a dark timber thinking I was in a great spot and I'm sitting waiting for, you know, the wind to shift or something. And I see a dude walking through and I'm just like, I feel like I'm back in Kansas City at a city park right now. You know, it was just odd. And then, 3 or 4 years ago, that unit went to a draw unit, but there's still just as many tags as there were when it was a OTC unit. So I don't know if it's gotten much better. So, you know, it's been a little bit different year in and year out as far as like how busy it is. One year we couldn't go there because, they shut it down for fires. So, you know, just been a little bit weird, but that first year was like, think about it. I've never been into that type of environment, never been in that dark timber. You know, never experienced it, never seen a wild elk up close. And so that first year, there were so many firsts for me. Plus there were a lot of things that happened that just, it was like, oh, I'm going to do this again. That was fun.
Yeah. What was it about, you know, like what was it specifically about that event that made you say, holy shit, dude, this is so much fun. I'm going to do this every year if I can.
I think, honestly, it was the very first morning when we, so where we were hunting, we would park the quads, and it was about a 2,000-yard walk across this open meadow to the base of this mountain. I say open meadow, you know, he had to cross a creek and all kinds of stuff. But, and when we got there, you know, we were kind of gassed a little bit. So we kind of sat there for a minute, kind of caught our breath. And the light is just starting to light. You're just starting to be able to see your face, you know, your hand in front of your face. And the second we stepped into that dark timber, it was like I stepped into a different world than I've ever been in. And
I like that.
The smells, and like every tree I looked at, I thought there was an elk behind it. You know, like, you know, I was that new, that kid in the candy store. Like,
right.
I was like, you know, almost like I had to be so quiet because the elk are right here. When in reality, we had to hike a while still.
Yeah, exactly.
But every step I took, I thought something's going to happen. Something's going to happen. Yeah. And that hit like that. That got me right away. Plus, like I said, my first year, that first day, we saw a bunch of elk. There was some elk shot that year, and we can talk more about that as well. But yeah, it was just like that. The second I stepped into that dark timber, it was like I knew I needed to be doing this.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, it does, man. It does. That was the same way with me and my first ever mule deer hunt I went on, where I'm just like, oh my God. I have so much fun stomping through the prairie looking for mule deer. It just connects with you. Sometimes it's not even about the animal. It's about the environment. And it sounds like the environment played a huge role in getting you hooked into coming back every year.
Yeah. And you also have to remember, like, it's not always just, it's not only about the hunting. It's about like the memories you're making with pretty much everybody that's with us is family. Somehow, sometimes, you know, 2 degrees removed, in-laws, whatever, but it's like the memories. And we finally recorded a podcast actually around the campfire on our last day a few years ago. And it was just so much fun. I mean, honestly, elk hunting is almost how our podcast even got started, because we would have these just great times around the fires when we get back and have dinner and talk about what happened that day and just, you know, make fun of each other and laugh about the stupid decision one of us made, or, you know, just, it was so much fun. We're like, man, people should, like, we should record this crap. And it's you know, some of the best times of my life have been, you know, sitting around those fires, dead tired, pissed off. And then you hear a story from your brother-in-law about what happened with them, and you're like, huh, that's funny. Or, you know, wow, that's cool. So yeah, it's you don't experience that, I don't think, any other way other than going and doing it. You know what I'm saying?
Yep. All right. So you guys camped about an hour, 2 hours away at a camp. Then you hopped on a quad. Was it like trucks, then quads, or was it quads right from the camp?
Quads right from the camp.
Okay. Quads right from the camp. And now you're gone. You're driving an hour to 2 hours on these roads to get back to wherever it is. Describe the layout or the terrain, because you've already mentioned dark timber. Describe the terrain that you're hunting these elk in.
Yeah. So where we're camped is kind of a, what I would call a transition area, where you have a decent amount of aspens that's starting to get crept in by the dark timber. And then basically, as soon as you get on the quads, you go through the trail point, the trailheads, where you can't take any vehicle that's wider than a certain width. And once you get in those trails, you go through some aspens for a while, and then it's like you break through the aspens, and then anything after that is going to be open or dark. And so, you know, you would typically park your quad somewhere off the trail, next to maybe an aspen, and then you're hiking up, and most of the time you're hiking right to dark timber, you know, right to the edge of the dark timber. Somewhere around, you know, 10,000 feet would be where you start. You end up somewhere around, let's say, you know, 11,000, depending on how far you get and that sort of stuff.
Yeah. Was it pretty steep where you were at?
Definitely in spots for sure. Yeah. You know, you had some areas where a little more gradual. But I remember we have this one hike that we call it 30 minutes of hell, because to get to where we want to hunt, it's about a 30 minute hike of pure hell. You know, the ground is right in front of your face the entire time, 'cause you're basically climbing straight up. And, but after that, it's not that bad. You get that over with and you're like, hey, I can handle this now. So, yeah, definitely something that you feel like you're prepared. And then that first day you're like, holy crap, I'm out of shape or whatever. Yeah.
Over the years, have you ever given yourself, like, once you get there, do you guys give yourself like 24 hours of acclimation, or when you get there, you set up and you go?
So typically we'll get there the day before season. Mm-hmm. So we actually leave, let's just say Saturday night typically was when we would leave. We would leave Saturday after supper, drive all the way through the night, get there Sunday morning about, you know, to camp probably around 10, 11 o'clock, set up camp, shoot our bows, get ready, and then the next morning would be hunting. And so we had about a half a day to get acclimated while we were setting camp up. I typically had a little bit of altitude sickness. Mostly just get dizzy while we're setting up camp, get tired real quick and have to go sit down for a little while. But usually by opening morning, everybody was good to go. Most people were younger, you know, for the most part. And but we could handle it. And we did preparation, so made sure we were nice and hydrated before we came out, that sort of stuff. But yeah, so typically, no, we got there about a half a day before we started hunting.
Okay. All right. And so as you get up into this 10,000 foot, you know, once you get off of the quads, are you hunting instantly, or are you like, are the elk at that level, or do you have to hike up still to go get the elk?
I mean, yes, technically you could be hunting instantly. Elk could be right there. And actually I've seen elk run right by quads before, you know, but no, typically, you know, you're still going to get hiking up into the dark timber and try to, you know, get somewhere where you think they have, you know, in your mind's eye, they're going to be down in the meadows at night. And then, you know, as the morning comes, they're going to retreat back up into the dark timber to those benches, to bed and things like that as the morning's, you know, going. And so you kind of feel like you're basically chasing them up the mountain before they get, you know, to their beds. Is essentially kind of what you're thinking. Plus, you know, if you're from the Midwest and you don't think about thermals too much, thermals are king out there. So the only thing you're worried about is in the morning, the thermals are coming down. And so you're trying to basically catch the elk before the thermals switch and they smell you. That's essentially kind of, you know, to dumb it down, that's kind of what's happening. And it's not fun to catch something that is so good at climbing.
Yeah, exactly.
But
so at that point, then, are you guys out there the whole day and then coming back at dark, or are you going back to camp?
Yeah, typically we're out there all day.
Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, you'll hunt, let's say the wind switches, you know, around lunchtime, usually a little before that. You'll try to find a spot where you like to be and just hunker down until those thermals switch totally. And then you can even either like side hill them and try to, you know, get some of the bulls up out of their beds, or just wait till the thermals start to switch again in the evening and then hunt them in the reverse manner, basically, on your way out, which I did not find much success in. That was usually where I had problems. But we were pretty much out there all day unless something happened. Somebody killed one. They needed help packing it out, or I don't know. I got so discouraged that I felt like saying, fuck it, I'm going to go back to camp or something. Right. But
Yeah. What about the mornings specifically? Did you like hunting better than the evenings?
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
You saw the game-winning play once, but have to replay it 3 times on the way back to the hotel. Because some moments don't end at the buzzer. Life's a trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Book direct and save at bestwestern.com.
I felt like we had a better chance in the mornings. Mm-hmm. You know, like they hadn't been bumped around yet by other hunters. I hadn't messed them up yet. I felt like the mornings were when you were going to get that chance, you know, if you were going to get it, which
yeah.
If we look at all the times we've killed elk or had seen elk or could have killed elk, I would say, you know, 75% of the time was before lunch, you know, but, and I think you're more sharp in the mornings too. You know, like at 5 o'clock at night, I've been out there all damn day hiking, you know, potentially 14 to 20 miles, depending on what we've done that day. I'm tired. And I think you can get sloppy as the day goes on. And I've definitely seen that where I'll make a huge mistake and think, what the hell were you doing?
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Out of curiosity, what direction was a majority of the face of the mountain? Like, was it a west face? Was it a north face slope where all these elk were at?
So my first year, we really focused on a north-facing slope. Okay. The two slopes that we've had the most success with in that area are it's a north-facing slope and an east-facing slope. Okay. Two totally separate mountains, but though that's the way those slopes are facing for the most part. Remember, we're not talking about perfection. There's going to be some variances in those.
Yeah.
But the one I hunted for probably my first 3 years, I stayed on that mountain almost exclusively, and it was a north-facing slope.
Okay. So north-facing slope means the sun is pretty much hitting it at all times of the day, right? From the time it creeps up to
this place, it was kind of other way around. The south slope on this mountain was the one that got hot quick.
Okay.
And so, and I think I'm doing this right. Yeah. The south facing slope is the one that got sun faster. Our side, typically the north side stayed cooler.
Because of the cover of the trees?
Because of the dark timber. Yeah. The other side was less dark timber. There was still timber, but it was not as thick. And then, yeah, so, I mean, but yeah, it would get sun. The sun felt like it was up in a heartbeat out there compared to what you're used to, maybe. It felt like as soon as you saw light, it was like nothing, and then there's the sun. You know, was just right there.
Yeah. Okay. And so you focused on a north-facing slope in the dark timber, and then about what time did the thermal start to shift from going down to up?
I would say as early as 9 o'clock, it was already switching. Okay. I mean, remember, it's getting light at 6, probably. I don't know exactly. I can't remember what times, but so you had several hours still, but I'd say as early as 9 o'clock, depending on what the weather was out there at that time, you'd already start having stuff swirl on you and your thermals would start moving uphill pretty quickly.
Okay.
Yep.
All right. Now, when you start to get up there, you know, you get on the quad and you go, then you get off the quad, you go on your hike and you're in the position to start hunting. How light was it at that point?
You could see everything. Yeah.
See everything. Okay. Yeah. All right. And then from that point on, were you guys doing a lot of calling? Were you waiting for, the elk to make the first move? What was your strategy at that point?
So the guys already kind of knew the area a little bit, but after I learned this too, you have to remember we are in an OTC unit, opening weekend. These elk are highly pressured elk. Mm-hmm. Calling, and also we're not rutting yet. We're the beginning of September, so it's kind of pre-rut out there. So calling wasn't super effective. You know, if you heard a bugle, there's a decent chance it wasn't an elk. It was it was a guy. So the way we decided to hunt was we would basically do some cow calling, move, let's say 100 yards up and then sit and wait. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times when we would see elk, they would come in quiet after a cow call. We barely heard cows ever talk.
Yeah.
But that, you know, it just felt like the elk weren't really bugling quite yet anyways. And I felt like they knew that they were getting called to. They were just, now we have had success with bugling them once we've heard them bugle and get calling them in. It has happened, but, it just felt like it was overkill a lot of times. So we tried to stay pretty quiet. We would do some light calling and then move and wait and try to see the elk, you know, circling in, try to get the wind. And we were successful that first year within the first hour, I had a bull at 80 yards. You know, it's just, unfortunately, you feel like you're so close to them, but yet so far away at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah. What's crazy is the amount of ground that they can cover in a very short period of time. Right. And that's an elk 101 conversation, right? When I got up there and I was like, oh my God, this elk is coming right at us. But he's above us, right? But if we keep going, we're going to meet him. But the next time he bugled, he's almost a mile further behind us now. And I'm just like, how, you know, it could have been where it's just a different bull, but how did this elk travel that far in that amount of time? Right. But it's just what they do.
And how they can be so quiet.
Oh, 100%.
If they want to be.
Yeah.
You weigh 800 pounds. How are you that quiet?
Yeah.
Yep.
Yep. I weigh over 200 pounds and I make a lot of noise just walking up the stairs of my house.
Yeah.
Right. So, and how these guys are so quiet, it blows my mind.
Well, I'll tell you a story. So this is actually my second year opening morning. Mm-hmm. So I told you, I saw that bull at 80 yards first morning, my first year. And it was just kind of like, oh man, that sucks. That's a fleeting, like he's out. So my second year, my Micah got to go. That was his first year. And so I'm with him and we get into this area that I started seeing elk the year before. So I wanted to call and then I wanted to go set up in this park, which for anybody that's listening, when I say park, basically it's an opening where there's no trees. So kind of some grass.
Yep.
And the park was on the bottom side of this bench. And I told him, I said, if the bull's above us, my thought is we're going to call and he's going to try to circle and catch the thermals of whatever called right here. And we should get a shot at him. And so we do it. And I thought I saw him and, you know, 10 minutes go by and nothing. And I'm like, man, he would come right here. I'm sure he would. It has to be, I feel like I know what I'm doing here. And 15 minutes go by and I'm like, man, I must've been seeing something. It wasn't a bull. And so I take my arrow out of my quiver or out of my, unknock my arrow, put it back in my quiver and we go to walk. And as soon as I clear that tree in the park that I thought I would have the elk coming in at, I just happened to glance and he's walking right at me, right where I thought he was going to come about 40 yards away and just stops and looks at me. And I'm like, what do I do with my hands? I'm 40 yards away from this beautiful bull. I mean, not a huge bull, but I don't give a shit. Like, I don't care how big it is. And I do this to my brother-in-law who's right behind me and the bull just looks at me. I look at him and he just turns and I've never seen something so big run so fast in my life and be gone. And I looked at my brother-in-law, I looked at Mike and I'm just like, you got to be shitting me. If we'd have stayed there for another 40 seconds, we would have had a 10 yard shot at a beautiful bull opening morning right off the bat.
Yep.
And, that's been the story of my elk hunting career is the could have beens. Everything has to go perfectly. And if one thing goes wrong, you're going home empty handed.
Yeah.
And, unfortunately I haven't been perfect yet. So it's one of them deals.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what is archery elk in Colorado statistics like for on success? Like,
well, it's 10%.
Seven?
Yep. 10%, I think total. But then my unit is like a 5.5 to 6% success rate.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
So, as you get up there and then, so you're saying the best time is in the morning. it's coming down and you're trying to, so you're hunting a lot of benches that kind of meet up with meadows and kind of clearings in on that north face.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially because, I mean, you can get shots off in the dark timber, but it's in some spots, it's pretty thick. I mean, it's 10 yards, 20 yards. And so you do want to give yourself a little bit of an advantage. So you want to get, you know, there's a couple spots up there, like the timber is thick, but you could maybe get a 60 yard shot off in certain spots.
Yeah.
And so like when you would decide to set up, you would try to do it strategically so that when you moved after you called, or if you called and just stayed put, you had an ability to take a shot.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, and then there's times where you're like, oh crap, this is going to, if we get a shot, he's going to be right here, but oh well.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's kind of the way we played it, you know, cause in the morning, yeah, they're moving up, but they're still feeding. They're still mulling around. They're still kind of doing their thing, their elk thing before it's bedtime. And so, you know, you can get them kind of doing their normal routine before those wind switches. And it seems like as soon as that thermal would switch, they would shut off and disappear and go to bed.
Yeah. Yeah. Were they bedding down in, were they on that wind shift? Were they already where they needed to be? Or did the wind shift then indicate like, okay, it's now from here, it's straight up? Or were they in their bedding locations when the wind shifted?
I felt like they knew when it was going to happen because they were like there. So I'll give you, for instance, this might've been my first year. So the mountain we're talking about, the top of the mountain, that ridge had an old horse trail on the top of it. And so if you picture this mountain, the top of it had like a mohawk because it had been cleared years before.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was kind of like an open trail. So the wind, we hadn't seen anything. Actually we had one encounter with a bull. And so we knew we had a bull near us and we knew he was going to go to the top somewhere and bed.
Okay.
When the wind shifted. So the wind started shifting. So we just started to hit, we decided to hit that trail. And then we were going to drop back down in and hunker down and either do some soft calling and try to side hill and get him up out of his bed. You know, you've heard of that midday madness thing. Or we were just going to wait until things changed that evening and try to hunt him out of his bed there. Well, we picked a terrific spot. As soon as we dropped down, we get 10 yards off that trail and boom, three bulls stand up and take off. And they were already down in their bed. And we literally walked right into where they were picked.
Mm-hmm.
So mm-hmm. I hate to say this. I was so good at saying where I thought they would be that I literally walked in on top of them. I didn't expect them to be right there, but they were. And obviously they got up and boogied straight. And of course, our dumbasses, they get up, take off downhill. So what do? Chase
right towards
them. Yeah. You know, we chased them and tried calling them and they saw us. So it was folly. So that's one of those days where like we got to where we wanted to, that happened. And then all of a sudden we're almost to the bottom of the mountain again. Cause we chased these elk. Now what do? You're in the worst setup.
Yeah.
So I think we ended up going back and eating lunch and coming back later that night.
Because
we had kind of screwed ourselves, but, so yeah, I think they're already in their beds when that wind shifts because they were there immediately. You know, we thought we had time to kind of get to where we wanted to go. And those bulls, there was three of them together. They were already laying down and, you know.
Chewing cud.
Yep, doing their thing.
So over the years, once you've made a mistake on an elk, right? It's almost like a whitetail sometimes where it's like, oh, he busted me, but I'm still going to rattle at him. And hopefully he turns around. He smelled me, but I'm going to rattle and maybe he'll change his mind. That never happens, right? So what have you guys done recently in recent years when something like that would happen where maybe an elk would catch your scent, he boogers out? How have you learned from that?
Well, that specific situation, we've gotten better at saying this one is over.
Yeah.
You know, like with whitetail, you were saying, you know, oh, he might come back. If you booger an elk there, you might be able to hunt that same elk a mile and a half away 4 hours later. So good luck getting there, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's going to run. They're going to be running for a while. They go like when they feel like they're in danger, they can cover ground so damn quick that it's over. If they smell you or see you. If they smell or see you, just wash your hands of that particular situation and regroup.
Yeah.
And move on to the next elk is kind of what we learned, because we would say, oh, there's an elk. Let's go kill it. That elk is no longer killable. You have ruined it. And you're not even going to catch it, first off. It's going to be maybe in the next unit by the time you get to where you're thinking you're going to go. So we've learned that is just when you make a mistake, learn from it, readjust, and try to find something else. Try to find another one. Yeah. And that typically would mean we would leave that general spot. You know, like if we were on this bench, let's say we were at 10,200 feet at this bench and we boogered a bull, then we're going to move to 10-4 half a mile west and try to reset up, because we just felt like we were out of the game at that point in that general spot.
Yeah. How many, from a quantity of elk standpoint, how many options did you have throughout the course of a day where in that specific scenario, where let's say you booger up a bull, he's gone, it's time to shift to a new location. Are you then running into elk again, or are you guys having trouble relocating elk?
Yeah. That first year. So there's been 2 years where we felt like the herd was there when we were there. Every other year every other year outside of those two, it's been like, ah, crap, there was our chance.
Yeah.
There was the elk, you know.
And does that ruin the entire week then?
Maybe, you know, like, I mean, yes, there's been years where, I think 1 year I saw one elk the entire trip.
Yeah.
You know, now I was the only person that had that bad of a year that year. But, and then, like I said, there's been other years where you're like, man, they're all over the place. But yeah, so like there's some times where you're like, oh shit, there goes our chance today. And that's a defeating feeling. Now, at the same time, it's hunting, anything can happen. Mm-hmm. But it's a defeating feeling when you're like, well, I freaking screwed that up. What do I do? You know, a lot of times we would take our packs off, sit down and eat a snack and complain for a few minutes before we made a decision. So,
well, that's the thing. Like, I can remember just the time and energy it takes to get to some of these spots. And I'm talking about one in particular where we would leave camp, we would drive a truck down this logging road, and then right around 10,000-ish feet, we would get out, and now we're going up 10,000 feet, another 1,000 feet, right? And so then we're at this little area where we have to try to locate these bulls. Okay, well, we heard one over here. Let's cross this little drainage and then come back up to these benches where they're at. And then boom, wind shift, boom, elk are gone. You can hear them running through the timber because they've busted us. And that whole ordeal, that whole process is a 4 hour process to hike up, get in position, wait for them to call. Then we think we're above them. You know, the wind shifts and they're above us and then done.
Over.
Right. It's over. Right. Which is that in itself is all, like just a huge defeat to the pride, I guess, or just like, God, I got to go and do this again. Especially if you're from, you know, 500 foot elevation, Iowa,
right.
Where you're not used to that shit.
Right now, get up to 20% off select online storage solutions. Put heavy duty HDX totes to good use, protecting what's important to you. The solid, impact-resistant design prevents cracking, and the clear base and sides make items easy to find, even when the totes are stacked. Find select online shelving and tote storage up to 20% off at the Home Depot to organize every room in your home, from your garage to your attic. Visit homedepot.com. How doers get more done.
Dude, it is the worst feeling. I'll never forget that first year, actually. So my brother-in-law, had one of the coolest encounters any of us have ever had. And so he was at the top of that mountain on the south slope. And it started raining on him. He was huddled up over under some pine trees, so he was kind of trying to stay dry. And it started raining, and it was towards the end of the afternoon. And so he just was like, you know what? Screw it. And he bugles. And he gets replied above him, like three different bugles. And he's like, no way, no way. Mm-hmm. Long story short, he gets... The way he told us the story, you can just like picture it in your mind, because we were back at the spot the next morning. I'll tell you the end of it. But so he's standing there and he sees these antlers coming up over this knoll, and this bull comes up over. And then right as he's about to shoot this bull, he sees a second set of antlers and then a third set. And then finally the fourth bull comes up and it's the big one.
Yeah.
And that bull comes up and then turns broadside at 35 yards and just bugles right in front of him. Mm-hmm. And he shoots it. And as soon as he shoots it, they all take off and it just starts pouring.
Oh my God. I mean, pouring.
And so he sits down for a few minutes and then he hears bugling back at the top of the mountain. And he's like, oh, is that the one I just shot? Or is it one of the satellite bulls that he was with? You know, that is now the big dog because I just killed this one. So the next day, you got to remember, down at camp that night, we're talking about this and we all drop what we're doing to go help him try to find this bull the next day.
Yep.
And you have to understand, we have a 4-hour hike just to get where he shot this bull.
Mm-hmm.
And then searching for the bull. We spend the entire day looking for any sign, any blood that might have not washed away, anything. And we never found this bull. So you got to remember, we're hiking just to try to find something at that point. You know, I don't even remember if I had a bow with me that day. But so there were times where they would bugle, obviously, but it was like, one of those craziest, you know, four bulls, each one bigger than the next, coming up over the hill. And, the one he shot was probably, you know, a beautiful, like 330-inch beautiful bull.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't meant to be.
That's a slap in the face. Thanks, Mother Nature.
Yeah.
That's crazy. Okay. So when you guys were going up to a spot, right? 4 hours to get up, 4-hour hike to get where you're going from the camp to this place. You go in there, you start doing your thing. The elk are maybe already in the bedding, or they're not responding, or what happens now after that wind shift? And now we're starting to talk about this 11 o'clock time frame, 10, 11, 12, all the way to 2, where there's probably not a lot going on. What are you guys doing in that time frame?
Sleeping.
Okay. That's fair, dude, because that's what I did.
When the elk go to sleep, we go to sleep. If we decided that we were going to hold off and see what we wanted to do, we would find a spot to eat our lunch and lay back and take a nap. Yeah. That was great, by the way.
Yeah. And so then basically at that time of year, cause it always sounds like you guys had gone that first week of September, correct?
Yeah.
Did you guys ever try going a different week, like closer to the rut time frame for them?
Unfortunately, no, because two of the individuals we went with were farmers and they had to be back for harvest. And so that's why we went so early. Outside of me going to Wyoming with my brother-in-law, Russell, that's when we went, because that's when they could go. And so we were always there opening day. So we were back by the, 10th to 12th of September, so they could start picking corn.
Yep. Makes sense.
Yep.
All right. So nap time, once nap time's over on, would you say, is there a time of day where they started moving more, that you guys now started getting in position for the descent they were making to food or water?
I felt like after that wind shifted, it got really hard to figure out if they were going to get up and do anything. I felt like any time we ran into an elk after, you know, lunch, we'll call it, you know, in the afternoon, I felt like it was us running into the elk that were in bed still. Yeah. I felt like they didn't do a lot of movement when it was in the height of the day with the thermals coming up. Because if you think about it, what reason would, if I were an elk, why would I need to get up? I'm at the top of the mountain. The thermals are coming towards me. And I'm at a bench where anything that comes behind me, I'm going to see. There's no need for me to move. I'm in a perfect scenario.
Yeah. Yeah. And so were they holding up until like right at last light?
Yeah. Felt like if we got any luck, it was like right there at dark. And they were finally starting to get up and kind of like finally, you know, peruse around and start thinking about moving down. That's why I said like most of the time mornings was where, you know, we got lucky. And then if we did get lucky during the middle of the day or towards the end of the evening, it was because we were being patient enough and moving to them. They weren't moving to us. We were getting them out of their beds.
Yeah. By calling or by bumping them?
Well, if we bumped them, it was over. Like you bump an elk out there. Now, it might be different in different areas, different units, different states. But you bump an elk there and that elk is gone.
Yeah.
So you had to hopefully get within 100 yards without them knowing you're there. And also remember, you probably don't know they're there either.
Right. You're guessing.
Yeah. So then you're calling and then hoping that they get up and you start seeing some movement. What you would kind of do, it's kind of weird. You'd have all these straight pine trees. If anybody's watching on YouTube or wherever, you'd have all these straight pine trees, right? And you would be looking through them and just hoping to catch
some kind of movement.
Some sort of movement. And that would be like your sign that there's something there.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of what, you know, you had to do sometimes.
Yeah. Okay. How many miles were you guys putting on a typical day from walking?
My longest day there was 21 miles, which was definitely a crazy day. We went to different areas.
Yeah.
But on average, I would say, you know, under five, somewhere in there. You know, if we stayed on that mountaintop, you know, you didn't make a lot of headway because you were doing a lot of climbing. So you were either going up or down. So, you know, 5 miles on average. And then if, like I said, we made some moves one day and did a lot of hiking, you know, so I've done 15, 20 mile days, 10 mile days, but on average, I'd say five was pretty normal.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Okay. Now, you mentioned that it went from like this, as you started going your first couple of years, it's fun just going out, you know, hanging with the boys and, you know, just having this all, you know, awesome camp life. Did it then ever, like, did you guys start having the conversation with us like, dude, there's maybe too many of us here, or we got to figure out a different strategy to get more shot opportunities throughout the trip?
Yeah. But it's a loaded question because there's two parts to that. So you got to remember over the counter Colorado.
Yep. Yep.
Your odds are not good.
Mm-hmm.
If we had been listening to people who were talking to us for years before, we would have been buying points in all kinds of different states, but we didn't right off the bat. And so we were a little behind. You also have to remember that we had a 63-year-old father-in-law and a 65-year-old dad who were going. And if the younger generation made a change to go somewhere that we had more shot opportunities, better odds, that would remove those two people probably from the equation because quads would no longer be involved. It wouldn't be as easy for Roger to get around as it was before. So we made the decision to stay mostly because, you know, Andy and my brother-in-law, Russ, they only have so many years left hunting in Colorado with their dads.
Yeah.
And once their dads decide they're done, then maybe some things will change.
Mm-hmm.
But until then, it's kind of like, hey, we'll keep beating our heads against the wall a little bit until we get enough points for potentially going somewhere else. Or different states. But yeah, it's kind of like you're behind the eight ball because you don't have enough points to draw somewhere better in Colorado. So you're like, well, I'm not going to use points to go somewhere else that might be just as shitty as here. And we know this place like the back of our hands.
Right.
You know, so we've got a better chance here than we would there. But yes, that has definitely been talked about. I don't think the number of guys with us mattered. Because when you were hunting, you were with one other person most of the time.
Right.
And it was a big enough area that you're not going to have to worry about another one of us, at least. Now, mm-hmm. there might be some dude from Texas that walks on top of you, but, yeah. you know, that's a different story.
Right.
So, yeah, it definitely is something we've talked about, making changes and...
Yeah. Okay. I mean, that's a tradition, right? And it's hard to turn your back on the people who invited you to go out in the first place anyway. You know what I mean? And so it's like, yeah, just deal with it until it's time to change it. And I'm sure you guys, once you get off, you know, once you guys get off the quads and start making the moves on your own, it's a completely different story than, you know, the whole hunt, at, you know, as a whole, moving it from different locations from what it was. Yeah. So outside of that, were there any specific conditions that seemed to, from a, like a weather standpoint, that seemed to get elk on their feet or have elk stay on their feet later or get them on their feet earlier in the day?
Cold temperatures.
Cold temps.
Yeah. Like if, when it got, and it, listen, there were years where like, holy crap, it's hot as it is in Missouri right now.
Right.
You know, in the middle of the day. And I knew, if I'm a big ass 700 pound, 800 pound bull, why in the world would I get up and walk around in this shit? And so, you know, I would try to find the darkest, you know, coldest spot. If I were an elk, that's where I would try to be because it's hot. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I loved getting up in the morning and it'd be freezing cold because you knew, okay, they're gonna stay up longer, hopefully. And if it was freezing cold, that means the thermals might stay down longer.
Yep.
As well. So it'd give us a little more chance. If I got up in the morning and I walked out and I'm like, crap, it's beautiful out, I knew it was going to be a short hunt because those thermals are going to switch quick.
Yep. Yep. And then, snow, you know, you're up pretty high and we've been there where it, it snowed, it has rained and then it goes away real quick. Have there been any days where, you know, because it's hard up there, right? There's no like forecast for, right. Hey, it's going to rain at noon today, like in the Midwest here. Here's the front coming in. That shit just kind of develops out there and it develops really quick.
Yep.
Were there ever days where you guys had to just stay at camp for 24 hours and go, or were you guys going no matter what?
Yeah, I would say like if we woke up, there was one year, there was a decent amount of rain, and we woke up one morning, and I mean, we had rivers running through our tent, mm-hmm. and it was just pouring.
Yeah.
You know, well, I'm not going anywhere, you know, because last thing you want to do is be at 10,400 feet shivering cold.
And wet.
Yep. And so, you know, that morning we all just went in the trailer and ate breakfast, and, you know, if the rain broke, then we moved. But there'd be those times. So I always had rain gear with me. Because, mm-hmm. Like you said, you could be up in the middle of the mountain and a thunderstorm hits. And actually, those were fun, to be honest with you. You'd be up, you know, right around lunchtime, let's say, moving, and then a thunderstorm hits, and you just pull the stuff out of your pack and hunker down, and you're staying dry, and you're getting thunderstormed on in the middle of a mountain. And it was just really cool. And you knew it wasn't going to last forever. So, we got hailed on one time. My brother-in-law were sitting there. We were laughing while we were getting hailed on.
Yep.
And thinking, if I were an elk, as soon as this is over, I'd be getting my ass up. You know, like, so you almost get excited during that thunderstorm.
Yeah.
And it quiets things down too. Like when it gets wet, then I can move more quiet. Now, so can the elk.
Right.
But at least I'm not popping every single thing I step on.
Yeah.
Dude, when it's dry out and you take one step and it's demoralizing.
Yep.
Yeah.
Did you guys have to go over a lot of deadfall when your guys are moving around up there?
Yeah. Deadfall was the worst thing up there, man. And my short ass was jumping over a lot of it. You know, Andy would just kind of go dunk, thunk, and I would have to be like, hold on, and take one leg over and then the next leg over.
Get the step ladder out. So from a strategy standpoint, what are some other things that maybe you have learned to put yourself in a better, like just continuously putting yourself, or like, maybe it's a general conversation that you guys have had at camp to put yourself into better positions every single year that you've gone elk hunting?
I think we learned, and we learned it quickly. If an elk is going to come and try to check out what you are trying to tell them to come check out, they are going to want the advantage. And they're going to want the advantage in both wind and position, which means they're going to want to be higher than you and have potentially the wind advantage. So where can I put myself to, which is why we would call and then move.
Right.
So if I were here, and I know it's, you know, if I were at 6 o'clock on a clock and I cow called hoping that the elk is going to come check that out, I'm going to move to, let's say, 3 on the clock, so that when the elk comes through the middle of the clock to check what I was being, I'm no longer downwind, I'm upwind.
Yeah.
And that elk thinks it's got the advantage because when I called, I was down there, not there.
Right.
And then also that elk thinks he's got the advantage elevation because when he heard that call, he was here. And now, so you could just tell they wanted to be above and smell every time.
So did they wait a lot of times for that wind shift to come? Maybe they were bugling and maybe they were responding to your calls, but they were waiting to come in to investigate until the wind shift?
All the damn time. And we knew, like, we knew as soon as, like, you'd be like, all right, he's up there. And as soon as you felt that wind tickle your back, the back of your neck, and go that way up, you knew, you're like, damn it.
Yeah.
Like, he waited for this, and he, and all it takes is a mile an hour wind to barely, or that those thermals just to barely waft uphill, and they will smell it. They will know.
Yeah. So the whole time then is you guys jockeying for position with that elk to try to get either level with him or at an angle to where your thermals are. He still might be above you, but he's not directly above you. And so you're like, you're side hilling or angling up towards him or away from him to try to get at least to a point where you're not going to get busted.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So like, you know, if you're, if it's, once again, I know I'm showing people that aren't, they're listening here, but if the elk is at the 12 o'clock position on a clock and I'm at 6 o'clock and I'm trying to catch him going up a hill, I've either got to get like to 11 o'clock with him so that he'll come over to 11 o'clock and die, or I've got to get over to 9 o'clock by the time the wind shifts so that he doesn't smell me over here.
Right.
And then maybe I can get him to get up out of his bed after the wind shifted. But if I'm at 6 o'clock and he's at 12 o'clock, when that wind shifts, I'm done.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, a lot of times you don't know exactly where they're at. So like, you think you might be in this right spot, but like, just kind of like I said, when we dropped in on those ones after the wind shifted, I thought I was in a good spot and I thought we were going to have ourselves set up for later that afternoon. I was just too good. You know, like I was literally perfect about where I thought the elk were. And, you know, that's not what, you don't want to walk in on top of them because you're not going to win that battle.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
If you were to look at that specific example again, would you have, and you didn't decide to go chase them, you said, okay, we know where they're bedding. How often do you bump them and then they're back there the next morning?
I don't think where we're at, I don't think it happens a lot. I do think bulls have their beds, you know, like on a point of a bench where they can see everything below them. I do. When we found them, stank like, stank like nothing else. You know, you knew there was a bull in there. But also there were so many spots for them to be that if I bumped them, you know, I'm not so sure they're exactly like whitetail, you know, the whole bump and dump thing. So like if I bumped an elk, I wasn't worried about trying to come back to that bed. You know, there was so many other opportunities for him to be somewhere that, you know, I think I burned that spot for at least a while till I'm gone. Gotcha. So,
okay.
Yeah. Right. Like in that specific situation, I wish I would have went further east instead of like as soon as I thought, essentially when that bench started, I thought this bull will be somewhere on this bench. So I'm going to drop into this bench now where it starts. Yeah. Yeah. And it just so happened that bull was right on the edge of that bench. Three of them.
Yeah.
And so I wish I'd have maybe went a little further, but my mind was saying, I'm going to start at the end of this bench. And when we start side hilling, hoping to get them up out of their bench, they're going to be further down to the east. They were all the way on the end of that bench. And I guess it makes sense now that I look back at it.
Yeah. All right. The last thing I kind of want to talk about today is when you started going west for elk, being a bow hunter from Missouri, how did you change? Or maybe you didn't. Did you change your arrow setup at all from whitetail to elk? And what did you do?
Let's see, that year, yes. So, well, I didn't change it. I made sure I set up my arrows for elk.
Yeah. And so, what did you do for that?
So that meant a fixed blade broadhead. Mm-hmm. So I didn't, you know, shoot mechanicals at whitetail. I'm a very anal person, so I don't like changing my setups. So if I'm going to hunt several different animals, I'm going to set my arrow up for the animal that's the worst, the hardest to kill, I will say. And so I set everything up for an elk. So I was shooting a fixed blade broadhead right off the bat. And then when I came back home, I just kept doing that because I knew that would work on a whitetail as well. So that's kind of how I did it. I mean, some people obviously probably do it differently. I can't handle, once I've got my arrow the way I want it, I don't want it changing.
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah.
Well, that's the exact same thing I did. I went from, I knew that I was going to have to do a little bit more, like get a little heavier arrow. And I wanted a fixed blade on there. So every year I went elk hunting, I also used a fixed blade for whitetails or whatever else I was hunting that year, just cause I didn't want to change. I didn't have the money to say, I have an elk bow and elk setup, and then I also have a whitetail setup. I just hunted my whitetails with my elk setup. Yeah. So yeah. Yep.
That's what I did.
And then over the course, like you didn't bump your arrow weight up or anything like that year?
So I'm blessed with a small body. And my biggest issue was I don't have super heavy arrows because I have a 27-inch draw. So I lose a decent amount of grainage. And then so I had to make a decision. Do I want a heavy arrow that's slow, or do I want a lightest, everything I'm going to shoot is light anyway. So I wanted it to be as fast as it could be so that it would pass through the elk and poke two holes. I want two holes. Yeah. I don't want one hole. So I wanted my arrow to be as fast as it could be without being, you know, super light. So like my arrows were like 435 grains because I mean, I just, unless I put 150 grain broadhead on the end of it, they're not going to be that heavy. But even at 435 grains shooting 70 pounds, I was only shooting 270 some feet per second.
Right.
So I didn't want to make my arrow 230 feet per second slow so that I could have a heavier arrow. Mm-hmm. So I kind of had to like just decide I want it to be as fast as it could be so that hopefully it has enough energy to make it through, you know, the animal. Whereas guys like Andy, hell, that dude shoots 300 feet per second with 540 grains because he's got a 32-inch draw.
Right.
You know, lucky him, but
yeah,
that's just not me. I've got, you know, short ass arms. So
yeah, nothing you can do about that.
Nope.
Nothing you can do about that. And then from a gear standpoint, is there any piece of equipment or gear that over the course of all of these elk hunts that you've done have been kind of like, dude, this one piece of gear, if I didn't have it, maybe it's from a comfortable standpoint, like it's a I don't know, a certain thing. Doesn't have to necessarily be the thing you use to kill the elk, but a product that you're just like, man, this is I can't imagine hunting without this thing or going on a hunt without this thing.
Can I say two things?
Yep.
Merino wool base layers.
The world moves fast. Your workday, even faster. Pitching products, drafting reports, analyzing data. Microsoft 365 Copilot is your AI assistant for work. Built into Word, Excel, PowerPoint, and other Microsoft 365 apps you use. Helping you quickly write, analyze, create, and summarize. So you can cut through clutter and clear a path to your best work. Learn more at Microsoft.com/M365Copilot.
I don't know what I would do without. I wear merino wool back at home now all the time. Even in the middle of the summer, I'll put 150 gram merino wool on because it keeps me less sweaty, which is weird because you're adding a layer.
Right.
But it's moisture wicking. It dries fast, keeps my poly outerwear from being as wet. So merino wool is a game changer.
Mm-hmm.
And then especially out west, you got to have a good pair of boots. And so, you know, whether that's Zamberlands or Crispies or I don't give a shit, find some boots that you like and use them way before you go out west to make sure you like them.
Yep.
Because if you don't like a pair of boots and you get out there, you're going to really know it.
100%.
Yeah.
My first elk hunt was a damn near disaster. Like, I think I was wearing work boots, dude.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
You know, they might even had steel toed in them.
Oh my. Right?
And I can't even remember. I was just like, I have no idea why all of a sudden I was just like, oh, I don't think I think I can make this work. Right. And just, of course I didn't have a ton of money, but still it was just, didn't have the merino, didn't have a good pair of socks, didn't have a good pair of boots. And it literally caught up with me on day one.
Day one.
That stuff.
You get a blister on your foot. Day like it's you're going to be in hell.
It's over.
Yep. Hot spot, whatever you want to call them, that you know you're in trouble. So
that's a fact.
Spend the money on the boots, man. I'm telling you, like, there's plenty of good brands out there, but you got to do it. It's a must.
Yeah. Here's the other thing. The last thing I want to talk to you about is this year. You are not going out.
I'm not.
You've gone out for what, 6 years, 7 years now, and this year you're sitting at home. Why all of a sudden have you decided to not go on a Western hunt this year?
Well, cause I suck at hunting. So I'm just going to, I do suck at hunting.
But... Number one. Okay. You suck. You're quitting. Okay.
Number one, I've lost. So I'm going to stay home and eat my tail between my legs. But, I've made a decision just to, be present with my family. This time of year is a great time for hunting, but it's also a horrible time to be gone. So,
yeah.
You know, where I'm at in my life, I've got a senior in high school. It's her, my daughter's senior year. And I've got a freshman in high school. And my daughter is a big time softball player. And Missouri plays fall softball.
Mm-hmm.
And so whenever I would go out west, you know, you're gone for 10 days, you're missing 6 to 10 games, which is like a third of their season.
Yep.
And my son, I'm going to miss 2 football games, which is a third of his season when he, you know, JV and then varsity, he'll miss 2 games. So, I just decided I don't want to miss those things. I want to be there for her senior year. I want to watch, I want to see my son play, you know, school football.
Yep.
And, so for the foreseeable future, I'm not going anywhere, out west, at least at this time of year.
Yep.
I just made that decision to, you know, be the dad, not the hunter this year.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Dude. And sometimes that's hard, especially when you've done that for X, however many years.
Yeah.
Right. To walk away from almost an annual routine of going and doing something could, you know, that could be pretty difficult, but at the same time, you're making the right decision, you know, watching your daughter play softball her senior year of high school.
Also, you know, and everybody's different, but I noticed even last year, I'd be thinking about home.
More
like, I wonder how her game's going tonight. And then I would purposely leave the woods early so that I could go get on the satellite phone and call my wife to see how everything, how the games went and, you know, hear what went on. And I just kind of found myself like, I'm more worried about what's going on at home than I am right here.
Yeah. Why am I here right
why
now?
Why am I even that, here? Yeah. So, yeah. So it's one of them deals where I'm just like, I'm going to bow out for a while then.
Yeah.
Yep.
That makes sense, man. You can't do that every year. So, and then when that time passes and you can get right back into the rigmarole of going out elk hunting after all of that, you know, after, you know, they're out of the house and you can get back to, you know, going and doing that stuff. But man,
I might have to do it in a wheelchair, but hey,
there you go. There you go. Hey, dude, you seen those wheelchairs that have those tank tracks on them?
Those are awesome.
I need one of those.
Yeah.
I need one of those.
Those are the coolest things I've ever seen, man.
Yeah. Nate, man, I really appreciate your time today. Thank you very much for taking time out of your day to hop on and talk elk hunting with us. If anybody wants to go listen to the Missouri Woods and Water podcast, I would highly recommend it. It is one of the best podcasts on the Sportsman's Empire podcast network. And you can go download their episodes anywhere that you download your podcast episodes, Spotify, iTunes, whatever. Nate, man. Good vibes this deer hunting season. Good vibes to you and your family, and have fun watching softball this fall.
All right, and to you as well. Hope all the guys, and hey, Missouri Woods and Water boys, I hope you guys slay some elk and we have some great stories to tell.
Your little one grew 3 inches overnight. Adorable. Also, expensive. Sell their pint-sized pieces on Depop and list them in minutes with no selling fees, because somewhere a dad refuses to pay full price for the clothes his kids will outgrow tomorrow, and he's ready to buy your son's entire wardrobe right now. Consider your future growth spurt budget secured. Start selling on Depop, where taste recognizes taste. Payment processing fees and boosting fees still apply. See website for details.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.